The Lovely Bones by Alice Sebold. Narrated by Alisa Bresnahan.
Inside the snow globe on my father's desk, there was a penguin wearing a red and white striped scarf. When I was little, my father would pull me into his lap and reach for the snow globe. He would turn it over, letting all the snow collect on the top, then quickly invert it. The two of us watched the snow fall gently around the penguin. The penguin was alone in there, I thought, and I worried for him. When I told my father this, he said, "Don't worry, Susie. He has a nice life. He's trapped in a perfect world." Chapter 1. My name is Salmon, like the fish. First name, Susie. I was 14 when I was murdered on December 6th, 1973. In newspaper photos of missing girls from the 70s, most looked like me, white girls with mousy brown hair. This was before kids of all races and genders started appearing on milk cartons or in the Daily Mail. It was still back when people believed things like that didn't happen. In my junior high yearbook, I had a quote from a Spanish poet my sister had turned me onto, Juan Ramón Jiménez. It went like this. If they give you ruled paper, write the other way. I chose it both because it expressed my contempt for my structured surroundings, a la the classroom, and because, not being some dopey quote from a rock group, I thought it marked me as literary. I was a member of the chess club and chem club, and burned everything I tried to make in Mrs. Delminico's home ec class. My favorite teacher was Mr. Boat, who taught biology and liked to animate the frogs and crawfish we had to dissect by making them dance in their waxed pans. I wasn't killed by Mr. Boat, by the way. Don't think every person you're going to meet in here is suspect. That's the problem. You never know. Mr. Boat came to my memorial, as, may I add, did almost the entire junior high school. I was never so popular. And cried quite a bit. He had a sick kid. We all knew this, so when he laughed at his own jokes, which were rusty way before I had him, we laughed too, forcing it sometimes just to make him happy. His daughter died a year and a half after I did. She had leukemia, but I never saw her in my heaven. My murderer was a man from our neighborhood. My mother liked his border flowers, and my father talked to him once about fertilizer. My murderer believed in old-fashioned things like eggshells and coffee grounds, which he said his own mother had used. My father came home smiling, making jokes about how the man's garden might be beautiful, but it would stink to high heaven once a heat wave hit. But on December 6th, 1973, it was snowing, and I took a shortcut through the cornfield back from the junior high. It was dark out because the days were shorter in winter, and I remember how the broken corn stalks made my walk more difficult. The snow was falling lightly, like a flurry of small hands, and I was breathing through my nose until it was running so much that I had to open my mouth. 6 feet from where Mr. Harvey stood, I stuck my tongue out to taste a snowflake.
"Don't let me startle you," Mr. Harvey said.
Of course, in a cornfield, in the dark, I was startled. After I was dead, I thought about how there had been the light scent of cologne in the air, but that I hadn't been paying attention, or thought it was coming from one of the houses up ahead. "Mr. Harvey," I said.
"You're the older Salmon girl, right?"
"Yes."
"How are your folks?"
Although the eldest in my family and good at acing a science quiz, I had never felt comfortable with adults. "Fine," I said. I was cold, but the natural authority of his age and the added fact that he was a neighbor and had talked to my father about fertilizer rooted me to the spot.
"I've built something back here," he said. "Would you like to see?"
I'm sort of cold, Mr. Harvey, I said, and my mom likes me home before dark.
It's after dark, Susie, he said.
I wish now that I had known this was weird. I had never told him my name. I guess I thought my father had told him one of the embarrassing anecdotes he saw merely as loving testaments to his children. My father was the kind of dad who kept a nude photo of you when you were three in the downstairs bathroom, the one that guests would use. He did this to my little sister, Lindsay, thank God. At least I was spared that indignity. But he liked to tell a story about how, once Lindsay was born, I was so jealous that one day while he was on the phone in the other room, I moved down the couch. He could see me from where he stood, and tried to pee on top of Lindsay in her carrier. This story humiliated me every time he told it, to the pastor of our church, to our neighbor Mrs. Stead, who was a therapist and whose take on it he wanted to hear, and to everyone who ever said, "Susie has a lot of spunk." "Spunk," my father would say. "Let me tell you about spunk." And he would launch immediately into his Susie peed on Lindsay story. But as it turned out, my father hadn't mentioned us to Mr. Harvey or told him the Susie peed on Lindsay story. Mr. Harvey would later say these words to my mother when he ran into her on the street. "I heard about the horrible, horrible tragedy. What was your daughter's name again?" "Susie," my mother said, bracing up under the weight of it, a weight that she naively hoped might lighten someday, not knowing that it would only go on to hurt in new and varied ways for the rest of her life. Mr. Harvey told her the usual.
"I hope they get the bastard. I'm sorry for your loss."
I was in my heaven by that time, fitting my limbs together, and couldn't believe his audacity. "The man has no shame," I said to Franny, my intake counselor. "Exactly," she said, and made her point as simply as that. There wasn't a lot of bullshit in my heaven. Mr. Harvey said it would only take a minute, so I followed him a little farther into the cornfield, where fewer stalks were broken off because no one used it as a shortcut to the junior high. My mom had told my baby brother, Buckley, that the corn in the field was inedible when he asked why no one from the neighborhood ate it. "The corn is for horses, not humans," she said. "Not dogs?" Buckley asked. "No," my mother answered. "Not dinosaurs?" Buckley asked. And it went like that.
"I've made a little hiding place," said Mr. Harvey.
He stopped and turned to me. "I don't see anything," I said. I was aware that Mr. Harvey was looking at me strangely. I'd had older men look at me that way since I lost my baby fat, but they usually didn't lose their marbles over me when I was wearing my royal blue parka and yellow elephant bell bottoms. His glasses were small and round, with gold frames, and his eyes looked out over them and at me.
"You should be more observant, Susie," he said.
I felt like observing my way out of there, but I didn't. Why didn't I? Franny said these questions were fruitless. "You didn't, and that's that. Don't mull over it. It does no good. You're dead, and you have to accept it." "Try again," Mr. Harvey said, and he squatted down and knocked against the ground. "What's that?" I asked. My ears were freezing. I wouldn't wear the multicolored cap with the pom-pom and jingle bells that my mother had made me one Christmas. I had shoved it in the pocket of my parka instead. I remember that I went over and stomped on the ground near him. It felt harder even than frozen earth, which was pretty hard.
"It's wood," Mr. Harvey said. "It keeps the entrance from collapsing. Other than that, it's all made out of earth."
"What is it?" I asked. I was no longer cold or weirded out by the look he had given me. I was like I was in science class. I was curious.
Come and see.
It was awkward to get into. That much he admitted once we were both inside the hole. But I was so amazed by how he had made a chimney that would draw smoke out if ever he chose to build a fire, that the awkwardness of getting in and out of the hole wasn't even on my mind. You could add to that that escape wasn't a concept I had any real experience with. The worst I'd had to escape was Artie, a strange-looking kid at school whose father was a mortician. He liked to pretend he was carrying a needle full of embalming fluid around with him. On his notebooks, he would draw needles spilling dark drips. "This is Nito," I said to Mr. Harvey. He could have been the hunchback of Notre Dame, whom we had read about in French class. I didn't care. I completely reverted. I was my brother Buckley on our day trip to the Museum of Natural History in New York, where he'd fallen in love with the huge skeletons on display. I hadn't used the word neato in public since elementary school.
"Like taking candy from a baby," Franny said.
I can still see the hole like it was yesterday. And it was. Life is a perpetual yesterday for us. It was the size of a small room. The mudroom in our house, say, where we kept our boots and slickers, and where Mom had managed to fit a washer and dryer, one on top of the other. I could almost stand up in it, but Mr. Harvey had to stoop. He'd created a bench along the sides of it by the way he'd dug it out. He immediately sat down.
"Look around," he said.
I stared at it in amazement. The dugout shelf above him where he had placed matches, a row of batteries, and a battery-powered fluorescent lamp that cast the only light in the room, an eerie light that would make his features hard to see when he was on top of me. There was a mirror on the shelf, and a razor and shaving cream. I thought that was odd. Wouldn't he do that at home? But I guess I figured that a man who had a perfectly good split level and then built an underground room only a half a mile away had to be a kind of Lulu. My father had a nice way of describing people like him. "The man's a character, that's all." So I guess I was thinking that Mr. Harvey was a character, and I liked the room, and it was warm, and I wanted to know how he had built it. What the mechanics of the thing were and where he'd learned to do something like that. But by the time the Gilbert's dog found my elbow 3 days later and brought it home with a telling corn husk attached to it, Mr. Harvey had closed it up. I was in transit during this. I didn't get to see him sweat it out, remove the wood reinforcement, bag any evidence along with my body parts, except that elbow. By the time I popped up with enough wherewithal to look down at the goings-on on Earth, I was more concerned with my family than anything else. My mother sat on a hard chair by the front door, with her mouth open, her pale face paler than I had ever seen it, her blue eyes staring. My father was driven into motion. He wanted to know details and to comb the cornfield along with the cops. I still thank God for a small detective named Len Fennerman. He assigned two uniforms to take my dad into town and have him point out all the places I'd hung out with my friends. The uniforms kept my dad busy in one mall for the whole first day. No one had told Lindsay, who was 13 and would have been old enough, or Buckley, who was 4 and would, to be honest, never fully understand. Mr. Harvey asked me if I would like a refreshment. That was how he put it. I said I had to go home.
"Be polite and have a Coke," he said. "I'm sure the other kids would."
"What other kids?"
"I built this for the kids in the neighborhood. I thought it could be some sort of clubhouse."
I don't think I believed this even then. I thought he was lying. But I thought it was a pitiful lie. I imagined he was lonely. We had read about men like him in health class. Men who never married and ate frozen meals every night and were so afraid of rejection that they didn't even own pets. I felt sorry for him. Okay, I said. I'll have a Coke. In a little while, he said, Aren't you warm, Susie? Why don't you take off your parka? I did. After this, he said, You're very pretty, Susie. Thanks, I said, even though he gave me what my friend Clarissa and I had dubbed the skeevies. Do you have a boyfriend? No, Mr. Harvey, I said. I swallowed the rest of my Coke, which was a lot, and said, I gotta go, Mr. Harvey. This is a cool place, but I have to go. He stood up and did his hunchback number by the 6 dug-in steps that led to the world. I don't know why you think you're leaving. I talked so that I wouldn't have to take in this knowledge. Mr. Harvey was no character. He made me feel skeevy and icky now that he was blocking the door. Mr. Harvey, I really have to get home. Take off your clothes. What? Take your clothes off. Mr. Harvey said. I want to check that you're still a virgin. I am, Mr. Harvey, I said. I want to make sure. Your parents will thank me. My parents? They only want good girls, he said. Mr. Harvey, I said, please let me leave. You aren't leaving, Susie. You're mine now. Fitness wasn't a big thing back then. Aerobics was barely a word. Girls were supposed to be soft, and only the girls we suspected were butch could climb the ropes at school. I fought hard. I fought as hard as I could not to let Mr. Harvey hurt me. But my hard as I could wasn't hard enough. Not even close. And I was soon lying down on the ground, in the ground, with him on top of me, panting and sweating, having lost his glasses in the struggle. I was so alive then. I thought it was the worst thing in the world to be lying flat on my back with a sweating man on top of me, to be trapped inside the earth and have no one know where I was. I thought of my mother. My mother would be checking the dial of the clock on her oven. It was a new oven, and she loved that it had a clock on it. I can time things to the minute, she told her own mother, a mother who couldn't care less about ovens. She would be worried, but more angry than worried, at my lateness. As my father pulled into the garage, she would rush about, fixing him a cocktail, a dry sherry, and put on an exasperated face. You know junior high, she would say. Maybe it's spring fling. Abigail, my father would say. How can it be spring fling when it's snowing? Having failed with this, my mother might rush Buckley into the room and say, Play with your father, while she ducked into the kitchen and took a nip of sherry for herself. Mr. Harvey started to press his lips against mine. They were blubbery and wet, and I wanted to scream, but I was too afraid and too exhausted from the fight. I had been kissed once by someone I liked. His name was Ray, and he was Indian. He had an accent and was dark. I wasn't supposed to like him. Clarissa called his large eyes, with their half-closed lids, freak-adelic. But he was nice and smart and helped me cheat on my algebra exam while pretending he hadn't. He kissed me by my locker the day before we turned in our photos for the yearbook. When the yearbook came out at the end of the summer, I saw that under his picture he had answered the standard, My heart belongs to, with Susie Salmon. I guess he had had plans. I remember that his lips were chapped. Don't, Mr. Harvey, I managed, and I kept saying that one word a lot. Don't. And I said please a lot, too. Franny told me that almost everyone begged please before dying.
I want you, Susie,
he said. Please, I said. Don't, I said. Sometimes I combined them. Please don't, or don't please. It was like insisting that a key works when it doesn't. Or yelling, I've got it, I've got it, I've got it, as a softball goes sailing over you into the stands. Please don't. But he grew tired of hearing me plead. He reached into the pocket of my parka and balled up the hat my mother had made me, smashing it into my mouth. The only sound I made after that was the weak tinkling of bells. As he kissed his wet lips down my face and neck, and then began to shove his hands up under my shirt, I wept. I began to leave my body. I began to inhabit the air and the silence. I wept and struggled so I wouldn't feel. He ripped open my pants, not having found the invisible zipper my mother had artfully sewn into their side. Big white panties, he said. I felt huge and bloated. I felt like a sea in which he stood and pissed and shat. I felt the corners of my body were turning in on themselves and out, like in Cat's Cradle, which I played with Lindsay just to make her happy. He started working himself over me. Susie! Susie! I heard my mother calling. Dinner is ready. He was inside me. He was grunting. We're having string beans and lamb. I was the mortar. He was the pestle. Your brother has a new finger painting, and I made apple crumb cake. Mr. Harvey made me lie still underneath him and listen to the beating of his heart and the beating of mine. How mine skipped like a rabbit, and how his thudded, a hammer against cloth. We lay there with our bodies touching, and as I shook, a powerful knowledge took hold. He had done this thing to me, and I had lived. That was all. I was still breathing. I heard his heart. I smelled his breath. The dark earth surrounding us smelled like what it was, moist dirt where worms and animals lived their daily lives. I could have yelled for hours. I knew he was going to kill me. I didn't realize then that I was an animal already dying. Why don't you get up? Mr. Harvey said as he rolled to the side and then crouched over me. His voice was gentle, encouraging. A lover's voice on a late morning. A suggestion, not a command. I couldn't move. I couldn't get up. When I wouldn't, was it only that? Only that I wouldn't follow his suggestion? He leaned to the side and felt over his head, across the ledge where his razor and shaving cream sat. He brought back a knife, unsheathed. It smiled at me, curving up in a grin. He took the hat from my mouth. Tell me you love me, he said. Gently, I did. The end came anyway. Chapter 2. When I first entered heaven, I thought everyone saw what I saw. That in everyone's heaven there were soccer goalposts in the distance and lumbering women throwing shot put and javelin. That all the buildings were like suburban Northeast high schools built in the 1960s. Large, squat buildings spread out on dismally landscaped sandy lots, with overhangs and open spaces to make them feel modern. My favorite part was how the colored blocks were turquoise and orange, just like the blocks in Fairfax High. Sometimes, on Earth, I had made my father drive me by Fairfax High so I could imagine myself there. Following the 7th, 8th, and 9th grades of middle school, high school would have been a fresh start. When I got to Fairfax High, I would insist on being called Suzanne. I would wear my hair feathered or up in a bun. I would have a body that the boys wanted and the girls envied. But I'd be so nice on top of it all that they would feel too guilty to do anything but worship me. I like to think of myself, having reached a sort of queenly status, as protecting misfit kids in the cafeteria. When someone taunted Clive Saunders for walking like a girl, I would deliver swift vengeance with my foot to the taunter's less protected parts. When the boys teased Phoebe Hart for her sizable breasts, I would give a speech on why boob jokes weren't funny. I had to forget that I, too, had made lists in the margins of my notebook when Phoebe walked by. Winnebagos, hoo-has, Johnny Yellows. At the end of my reveries, I sat in the back of the car as my father drove. I was beyond reproach. I would overtake high school in a matter of days, not years, or inexplicably earn an Oscar for Best Actress during my junior year. These were my dreams on Earth. After a few days in heaven, I realized that the javelin throwers and the shot putters and the boys who played basketball on the cracked black top were all in their own version of heaven. Theirs just fit with mine. Didn't duplicate it precisely, but had a lot of the same things going on inside. I met Holly, who became my roommate, on the third day. She was sitting on the swing set. I didn't question that a high school had swing sets. That's what made it heaven. And no flat-benched swings, only bucket seats made out of hard black rubber that cradled you and that you could bounce in a bit before swinging. Holly sat reading a book in a weird alphabet that I associated with the pork-fried rice my father brought home from Hop Fat Kitchen, a place Buckley loved the name of. Loved so much he yelled, "Hop Fat!" at the top of his lungs. Now I know Vietnamese, and I know that Vietnamese isn't what Herman Jade, who owned Hop Fat, was, and that Herman Jade wasn't Herman Jade's real name, but one he adopted when he came to the U.S. from China. Holly taught me all this. "Hi," I said. "My name is Susie." Later, she would tell me she picked her name from a movie, Breakfast at Tiffany's. But that day, it rolled right off her tongue. "I'm Holly," she said. Because she wanted no trace of an accent in her heaven, she had none. I stared at her black hair. It was shiny, like the promises in magazines. "How long have you been here?" I asked. "3 days." "Me too." I sat down on the swing next to her and twisted my body around and around to tie up the chains. Then I let go and spun until I stopped. "Do you like it here?" she asked. "No." "Me either." So it began. We had been given, in our heavens, our simplest dreams. There were no teachers in the school. We never had to go inside except for art class for me and jazz band for Holly. The boys didn't pinch our backsides or tell us we smelled. Our textbooks were 17 and Glamour and Vogue. And our heavens expanded as our relationship grew. We wanted many of the same things. Franny, my intake counselor, became our guide. Franny was old enough to be our mother, mid-40s. And it took Holly and me a while to figure out that this had been something we wanted. Our mothers. In Franny's heaven, she served and was rewarded by results and gratitude. On Earth, she had been a social worker for the homeless and destitute. She worked out of a church named St. Mary's that served meals to women and children only, and she did everything there from manning the phones to swatting the roaches, karate chop style. She was shot in the face by a man looking for his wife. Franny walked over to Holly and me on the fifth day. She handed us 2 Dixie cups of lime Kool-Aid, and we drank. "I'm here to help," she said. I looked into her small blue eyes surrounded by laugh lines and told her the truth. "We're bored." Holly was busy trying to reach her tongue out far enough to see if it had turned green.
What do you want? Franny asked.
I don't know, I said.
All you have to do is desire it. And if you desire it enough and understand why, really know, it will come. It seemed so simple, and it was. That's how Holly and I got our duplex. I hated our split level on Earth. I hated my parents' furniture and how our house looked out onto another house and another house and another, an echo of sameness riding up over the hill. Our duplex looked out onto a park, and in the distance, just close enough to know we weren't alone, but not too close, we could see the lights of other houses. Eventually, I began to desire more. What I found strange was how much I desired to know what I hadn't known on Earth. I wanted to be allowed to grow up. People grow up by living, I said to Franny. I want to live. That's out, she said. Can we at least watch the living? Asked Holly. You already do, she said. I think she means whole lives, I said, from beginning to end, to see how they did it, to know the secrets. Then we can pretend better. You won't experience it, Franny clarified. Thank you, Brain Central, I said. But our heavens began to grow. There was the high school still, all the Fairfax architecture, but now there were roads leading out. Walk the paths, Franny said, and you'll find what you need. So that's when Holly and I set out. Our heaven had an ice cream shop, where when you asked for peppermint stick ice cream, no one ever said, it's seasonal. It had a newspaper where our pictures appeared a lot and made us look important. It had real men in it, and beautiful women, too, because Holly and I were devoted to fashion magazines. Sometimes Holly seemed like she wasn't paying attention, and other times she was gone when I went looking for her. That was when she went to a part of heaven we didn't share. I missed her then, but it was an odd sort of missing, because by then I knew the meaning of forever. I couldn't have what I wanted most, Mr. Harvey dead and me living. Heaven wasn't perfect. But I came to believe that if I watched closely and desired, I might change the lives of those I loved on Earth. My father was the one who took the phone call on December 9th. It was the beginning of the end. He gave the police my blood type, had to describe the lightness of my skin. They asked him if I had any identifying features. He began to describe my face in detail, getting lost in it. Detective Fennerman let him go on, the next news too horrible to interrupt with. But then he said it. Mr. Salmon, we have found only a body part. My father stood in the kitchen and a sickening shiver overtook him. How could he tell that to Abigail? So you can't be certain that she's dead? He asked. Nothing is ever certain, Len Fennerman said. That was the line my father said to my mother. Nothing is ever certain. For 3 nights, he hadn't known how to touch my mother or what to say. Before, they had never found themselves broken together. Usually it was one needing the other, but not both needing each other. And so there had been a way, by touching, to borrow from the stronger one's strength. And they had never understood, as they did now, what the word horror meant. Nothing is ever certain, my mother said, clinging to it, as he had hoped she might. My mother had been the one who knew the meaning of each charm on my bracelet, where we had gotten it, and why I liked it. She made a meticulous list of what I'd carried and worn. If found miles away and in isolation along a road, these clues might lead a policeman there to link it to my death.
In my mind, I had wavered between the bittersweet joy of seeing my mother name all the things I carried and loved, and her futile hope that these things mattered. That a stranger who found a cartoon character eraser or a rock star button would report it to the police. After Len's phone call, my father reached out his hand, and the two of them sat in the bed together, staring straight in front of them. My mother numbly clinging to this list of things, my father feeling as if he were entering a dark tunnel. At some point, it began to rain. I could feel them both thinking the same thing then, but neither of them said it. That I was out there somewhere, in the rain. That they hoped I was safe. That I was dry somewhere, and warm. Neither of them knew who fell asleep first, their bones aching with exhaustion. They drifted off and woke guiltily at the same time. The rain, which had changed several times as the temperature dropped, was now hail, and the sound of it, of small stones of ice hitting the roof above them, woke them together. They did not speak. They looked at each other in the small light cast from the lamp left on across the room. My mother began to cry, and my father held her, wiped her tears with the pad of his thumbs as they crested her cheekbones, and kissed her very gently on the eyes. I looked away from them then, as they touched. I moved my eyes into the cornfield, seeing if there was anything that in the morning the police might find. The hail bent the stalks and drove all the animals into their holes. Not so deep beneath the earth were the warrens of the wild rabbits I loved, the bunnies that ate the vegetables and flowers in the neighborhood nearby, and that sometimes, unwittingly, brought poison home to their dens. Then, inside the earth and so far away from the man or woman who had laced a garden with toxic bait, an entire family of rabbits would curl into themselves and die. On the morning of the 10th, my father poured the scotch down the kitchen sink. Lindsay asked him why.
"I'm afraid I might drink it," he said.
"What was the phone call?" my sister asked.
"What phone call?"
"I heard you say that thing you always say about Susie's smile, about stars exploding."
"Did I say that?"
"You got kind of goofy. It was a cop, wasn't it?"
"No lies?"
"No lies," Lindsay agreed.
"They found a body part. It might be Susie's."
"It was a hard sock in the stomach."
"What?" "Nothing is ever certain," my father tried.
Lindsay sat down at the kitchen table. "I'm going to be sick," she said.
"Honey?"
"Dad, I want you to tell me what it was. Which body part? And then I'm going to need to throw up." My father got down a large metal mixing bowl. He brought it to the table and placed it near Lindsay before sitting down. "Okay," she said. "Tell me."
"It was an elbow. The Gilbert's dog found it."
He held her hand, and then she threw up, as she had promised, into the shiny silver bowl. Later that morning, the weather cleared, and not too far off from my house, the police roped off the cornfield and began their search. The rain, sleet, snow, and hail, melting and mixing, had left the ground sodden. Still, there was an obvious area where the earth had been freshly manipulated. They began there and dug. In places, the lab later found, there was a dense concentration of my blood mixed with the dirt, but at the time the police grew more and more frustrated, plying the cold, wet ground and looking for a girl. Along the border of the soccer field, a few of my neighbors kept a respectful distance from the police tape, wondering at the men dressed in heavy blue parkas wielding shovels and rakes like medical tools. My father and mother remained at home. Lindsay stayed in her room. Buckley was nearby at his friend Nate's house, where he spent a lot of time these days. They had told him I was on an extended sleepover at Clarissa's. I knew where my body was, but I couldn't tell them. I watched and waited to see what they would see. And then, like a thunderbolt, late in the afternoon, a policeman held up his earth-caked fist and shouted. "Over here," he said, and the other officers ran to surround him. The neighbors had gone home except for Mrs. Stead. After conferring around the discovering policeman, Detective Fennerman broke their dark huddle and approached her. "Mrs. Stead?" he said over the tape that separated them. "Yes." "You have a child in the school?" "Yes." "Could you come with me, please?" A young officer led Mrs. Stead under the police tape and over the bumpy, churned-up cornfield to where the rest of the men stood. "Mrs. Stead," Len Fennerman said, "does this look familiar?" He held up a paperback copy of To Kill a Mockingbird. "Do they read this at the school?" "Yes," she said, her face draining of color as she said the small word. "Do you mind if I ask you," he began. "Ninth grade," she said, looking into Len Fennerman's slate blue eyes. "Susie's grade." She was a therapist and relied on her ability to hear bad news and discuss rationally the difficult details of her patients' lives, but she found herself leaning into the young policeman who had led her over. I could feel her wishing that she had gone home when the other neighbors had left, wishing that she was in the living room with her husband or out in the backyard with her son. "Who teaches the class?" "Mrs. DeWitt," Mrs. Stead said. "The kids find it a real relief after Othello."
"Othello?"
"Yes," she said, her knowledge of the school suddenly very important right now, all the policemen listening. "Mrs. DeWitt likes to modulate her reading list, and she does a big push right before Christmas with Shakespeare. Then she passes out Harper Lee as a reward. If Susie was carrying around To Kill a Mockingbird, it means she must have turned in her paper on Othello already." All of this checked out. The police made calls. I watched the circle widen. Mrs. DeWitt had my paper. Eventually, she sent it back to my parents, unmarked, through the mail. "Thought you would want to have this," Mrs. DeWitt had written on the note attached to it. "I'm so very, very sorry." Lindsay inherited the paper because it was too painful for my mother to read. The Ostracized, One Man Alone, I had called it. Lindsay had suggested The Ostracized, and I had made up the other half. My sister punched three holes down the side of it and fastened each carefully handwritten page into an empty notebook. She put it in her closet under her Barbie case and the box that held her perfect condition Raggedy Ann and Andy that I'd envied. Detective Fennerman called my parents. They had found a school book, they believed, that might have been given to me that last day.
"But it could be anyone's,"
my father said to my mother as they began another restless vigil.
"Or she could have dropped it along the way."
Evidence was mounting, but they refused to believe. 2 days later, on December 12th, the police found my notes from Mr. Boat's class. Animals had carried off the notebook from its original burial site. The dirt didn't match the surrounding samples, but the graph paper, with its scribbled theories that I could never understand but still dutifully recorded, had been found where a cat knocked down a crow's nest. Shreds of the paper were laced among the leaves and twigs. The police unbraided the graph paper, along with strips of another kind of paper, thinner and brittle, that had no lines. The girl who lived in the house where the tree stood recognized some of the handwriting. It wasn't my writing, but the writing of the boy who had a crush on me, Ray Singh. On his mother's special rice paper,
Ray had written me a love note, which I never read. He had tucked it into my notebook during our Wednesday lab. His hand was distinct. When the officers came, they had to piece together the scraps of my biology notebook and of Ray Singh's love note. "Ray is not feeling well," his mother said when a detective called his house and asked to speak to him. But they found out what they needed from her. Ray nodded to her as she repeated the policeman's questions to her son. Yes, he had written Susie Salmon a love note. Yes, he had put it in her notebook after Mr. Boat had asked her to collect the pop quiz. Yes, he had called himself the Moor. Ray Singh became the first suspect. "That sweet boy?" my mother said to my father. "Ray Singh is nice," my sister said in a monotone at dinner that night. I watched my family and knew they knew. It wasn't Ray Singh. The police descended on his house, leaning heavily on him, insinuating things. They were fueled by the guilt they read into Ray's dark skin, by the rage they felt at his manner, and by his beautiful yet too exotic and unavailable mother. But Ray had had an alibi. A whole host of nations could be called to testify on his behalf. His father, who taught post-colonial history at Penn, had urged his son to represent the teenage experience at a lecture he gave at the International House on the day I died. At first, Ray's absence from school had been seen as evidence of his guilt. But once the police were presented with a list of 45 attendees who had seen Ray speak at Suburbia, the American Experience, they had to concede his innocence. The police stood outside the Singh house and snapped small twigs from the hedges. It would have been so easy, so magical, their answer literally falling out of the sky from a tree. But rumors spread, and in school, what little headway Ray had made socially was reversed. He began to go home immediately after school. All this made me crazy. Watching but not being able to steer the police toward the green house so close to my parents, where Mr. Harvey sat carving finials for a gothic dollhouse he was building, he watched the news, scanned the papers. But he wore his own innocence like a comfortable old coat. There had been a riot inside him, and now there was calm. I tried to take solace in Holiday, our dog. I missed him in a way I hadn't yet let myself miss my mother and father, my sister and brother. That way of missing would mean that I had accepted that I would never be with them again. It might sound silly, but I didn't believe it. Wouldn't believe it. Holiday stayed with Lindsay at night, stood by my father each time he answered the door to a new unknown, gladly partook of any clandestine eating on the part of my mother, let Buckley pull his tail and ears inside the house of locked doors. There was too much blood in the earth. On December 15th, among the knocks on the door that signaled to my family that they must numb themselves further before opening their house to strangers, the kind but awkward neighbors, the bumbling but cruel reporters, came the one that made my father finally believe. It was Len Fenneman, who had been so kind to him, and a uniform. They came inside. By now familiar enough with the house to know that my mother preferred them to come in and say what they had to say in the living room so that my sister and brother wouldn't overhear. "We've found a personal item that we believe to be Susie's," Len said. Len was careful. I could see him calculating his words. He made sure to specify so that my parents would be relieved of their first thought, that the police had found my body. That I was, for certain, dead. "What?" my mother said impatiently. She crossed her arms and braced for another inconsequential detail in which others invested meaning. She was a wall, Notebooks and novels were nothing to her. Her daughter might survive without an arm. A lot of blood was a lot of blood. It was not a body. Jack had said it, and she believed. Nothing is ever certain. But when they held up the evidence bag with my hat inside, something broke in her. The fine wall of leaden crystal that had protected her heart somehow numbed her into disbelief, shattered. "The pom-pom," Lindsay said. She had crept into the living room from the kitchen. No one had seen her come in but me. My mother made a sound and reached out her hand. The sound was a metallic squeak, a human as machine, breaking down, uttering last sounds before the whole engine locks.
"We've tested the fibers," Len said. "It appears whoever accosted Susie used this during the crime."
"What?" my father asked. He was powerless. He was being told something he couldn't comprehend.
"As a way to keep her quiet."
"What?"
"It's covered with her saliva." The uniformed officer, who had been silent until now, volunteered.
"He gagged her with it."
My mother grabbed it out of Len Fenneman's hands, and the bells she had sewn into the pom-pom sounded as she landed on her knees. She bent over the hat she had made me. I saw Lindsay stiffen at the door. Our parents were unrecognizable to her. Everything was unrecognizable. My father led the well-meaning Len Fenneman and the uniformed officer to the front door.
"Mr. Salmon," Len Fenneman said, "with the amount of blood we've found and the violence, I'm afraid it implies, as well as other material evidence we've discussed, we must work with the assumption that your daughter has been killed."
Lindsay overheard what she already knew, had known since 5 days before when my father told her about my elbow. My mother began to wail.
"We'll be working with this as a murder investigation from this point out,"
Fenneman said.
"But there is no body," my father tried.
"All evidence points to your daughter's death. I'm very sorry."
The uniformed officer had been staring to the right of my father's pleading eyes. I wonder if that was something they'd taught him in school. But Len Fenneman met my father's gaze.
"I'll call to check in on you later today," he said.
By the time my father turned back to the living room, he was too devastated to reach out to my mother sitting on the carpet or my sister's hardened form nearby. He couldn't let them see him. He mounted the stairs, thinking of Holiday on the rug in the study. He had last seen him there. Into the deep ruff of fur surrounding the dog's neck, my father would let himself cry. That afternoon, the three of them crept forward in silence, as if the sound of footsteps might confirm the news. Nate's mother knocked on the door to return Buckley. No one answered. She stepped away, knowing something had changed inside the house, which looked exactly like the ones on either side of it. She made herself my brother's co-conspirator, telling him they would go out for ice cream and ruin his appetite. At 4, my mother and father ended up standing in the same room downstairs. They had come in from opposite doorways. My mother looked at my father.
"Mother," she said,
and he nodded his head. He made the phone call to my only living grandparent, my mother's mother, Grandma Lynn. I worried that my sister, left alone, would do something rash. She sat in her room on the old couch my parents had given up on and worked on hardening herself. "Take deep breaths and hold them. Try to stay still for longer and longer periods of time. Make yourself small and like a stone. Curl the edges of yourself up and fold them under where no one can see." My mother told her it was her choice whether she wanted to return to school before Christmas. There was only 1 week left, but Lindsay chose to go. On Monday, in homeroom, everyone stared at her as she approached the front of the classroom. "The principal would like to see you, dear," Mrs. DeWitt confided in a hush. My sister didn't look at Mrs. DeWitt when she was speaking. She was perfecting the art of talking to someone while looking through them. That was my first clue that something would have to give. Mrs. DeWitt was also the English teacher, but more importantly, she was married to Mr. DeWitt, who coached boys' soccer, and had encouraged Lindsay to try out for his team. My sister liked the DeWitts, but that morning she began looking into the eyes of only those people she could fight against. As she gathered her things, she heard whispers everywhere. She was certain that right before she left the room, Danny Clark had whispered something to Sylvia Henley. Someone had dropped something near the back of the classroom. They did this, she believed, so that on their way to pick it up and back again, they could say a word or two to their neighbor about the dead girl's sister. Lindsay walked through the hallways and in and out of the rows of lockers, dodging anyone who might be near. I wished I could walk with her, mimic the principal and the way he always started out a meeting in the auditorium. "Your principal is your pal with principals," I would whine in her ear, cracking her up. But while she was blessed with empty halls, when she reached the main office, she was cursed with the drippy looks of consoling secretaries. No matter. She had prepared herself at home in her bedroom. She was armed to the teeth for any onslaught of sympathy. "Lindsay," Principal Caden said, "I received a call from the police this morning. I'm sorry to hear of your loss." She looked right at him. It wasn't so much a look as a laser. "What exactly is my loss?" Mr. Caden felt he needed to address issues of children's crises directly. He walked out from behind his desk and ushered Lindsay onto what was commonly referred to by the students as the sofa. Eventually, he would replace the sofa with two chairs when politics swept through the school district and told him, "It isn't good to have a sofa here. Chairs are better. Sofas send the wrong message." Mr. Caden sat on the sofa, and so did my sister. I like to think she was a little thrilled in that moment, no matter how upset, to be on the sofa itself. I like to think I hadn't robbed her of everything. "We're here to help in any way we can," Mr. Caden said. He was doing his best. "I'm fine," she said. "Would you like to talk about it?" "What?" Lindsay asked. She was being what my father called petulant, as in, "Susie, don't speak to me in that petulant tone." "Your loss," he said. He reached out to touch my sister's knee. His hand was like a brand burning into her. "I wasn't aware I had lost anything," she said. And in a Herculean effort, she made the motions of patting her shirt and checking her pockets. Mr. Caden didn't know what to say. He had had Vicky Kurtz fall apart in his arms the year before. It had been difficult, yes, but now, in hindsight, Vicky Kurtz and her dead mother seemed an artfully handled crisis. He had led Vicky Kurtz to the couch. No. Vicky had just gone right over and sat down on it. He had said, "I'm sorry for your loss." And Vicky Kurtz had burst like an overinflated balloon. He held her in his arms as she sobbed and sobbed, and that night he brought his suit to the dry cleaners. But Lindsay Salmon was another thing altogether. She was gifted, one of the 20 students from his school who had been selected for the statewide gifted symposium. The only trouble in her file was a slight altercation early in the year when a teacher reprimanded her for bringing obscene literature fear of flying, into the classroom.
"Make her laugh," I wanted to say to him. "Bring her to a Marx Brothers movie. Sit on a fart cushion. Show her the boxers you have on with the little devils eating hot dogs on them."
All I could do was talk, but no one on earth could hear me. The school district made everyone take tests and then decided who was gifted and who wasn't. I like to suggest to Lindsay that I was much more pissed off by her hair than by my Dumbo status. We had both been born with masses of blonde hair, but mine quickly fell out and was replaced with a grudging growth of mousy brown. Lindsay's stayed and acquired a sort of mythical place. She was the only true blonde in our family. But once called gifted, it had spurred her on to live up to the name. She locked herself in her bedroom and read big books. When I read Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, she read Camus' Resistance, Rebellion, and Death. She might not have gotten most of it, but she carried it around, and that made people, including teachers, begin to leave her alone.
"What I'm saying, Lindsay, is that we all miss Susie,"
Mr. Caden said. She didn't respond.
"She was very bright,"
he tried. She stared blankly back at him.
"It's on your shoulders now."
He had no idea what he was saying, but he thought the silence might mean he was getting somewhere.
"You're the only salmon girl now."
"Nothing."
"You know who came in to see me this morning?"
Mr. Caden had held back his big finish, the one he was sure would work.
"Mr. DeWitt. He's considering coaching a girls' team,"
Mr. Caden said.
"The idea is all centered around you. He's watched how good you are, as competitive as his boys, and he thinks other girls would come out if you led the charge. What do you say?"
Inside, my sister's heart closed like a fist. I'd say it would be pretty hard to play soccer on the soccer field when it's approximately 20 feet from where my sister was supposedly murdered.
"Score!"
Mr. Caden's mouth opened, and he stared at her. "Anything else?" Lindsay asked.
"No, I..."
Mr. Caden reached out his hand again. There was a thread still, a desire to understand.
"I want you to know how sorry we are," he said.
"I'm late for first period," she said. In that moment, she reminded me of a character in the westerns my father loved, the ones we watched together on late-night TV. There was always a man who, after he shot his gun, raised the pistol to his lips and blew air across the opening. Lindsay got up and took the walk out of Principal Caden's office, slow. The walks away were her only rest time. Secretaries were on the other side of the door. Teachers were at the front of the class, students in every desk, our parents at home, police coming by. She wouldn't break. I watched her, felt the lines she repeated over and over again in her head. "Fine. All of it is fine." I was dead. But that was something that happened all the time. People died. As she left the outer office that day, she appeared to be looking into the eyes of the secretaries. But she was focusing on their misapplied lipstick or two-piece paisley crepe de chine instead. At home that night, she lay on the floor of her room and braced her feet under her bureau. She did 10 sets of sit-ups. Then she got into push-up position, not the girl's kind. Mr. DeWitt had told her about the kind he had done in the Marines, head up or one-handed, clapping between. After she did 10 push-ups, she went to her shelf and chose the 2 heaviest books, her dictionary and a world almanac. She did bicep curls until her arms ached. She focused only on her breathing. The in, the out. I sat in the gazebo in the main square of my heaven. Our neighbors, the O'Dwyers, had had a gazebo. I had grown up jealous for one. And watched my sister rage. Hours before I died, my mother hung on the refrigerator a picture that Buckley had drawn. In the drawing, a thick blue line separated the air and ground. In the days that followed, I watched my family walk back and forth past that drawing, and I became convinced that that thick blue line was a real place, an in-between, where heaven's horizon met earth's. I wanted to go there into the cornflower blue of Crayola, the royal, the turquoise, the sky. Often I found myself desiring simple things, and I would get them. Riches in furry packages. Dogs. Every day in my heaven, tiny dogs and big dogs, dogs of every kind, ran through the park outside my room. When I opened the door, I saw them fat and happy, skinny and hairy, lean and hairless even. Pit bulls rolled on their backs, the nipples of the females distended and dark, begging for their pups to come and suckle them. Happy in the sun. Bassets tripped over their ears, ambling forward, nudging the rumps of dachshunds, the ankles of greyhounds, and the heads of the Pekingese. And when Holly took her tenor sax, set herself up outside the door that looked onto the park and played the blues, the hounds all ran to form her chorus. On their haunches, they sat wailing. Other doors opened then, and women stepped out from where they lived alone or with roommates. I would step outside. Holly would go into an endless encore, the sun going down, and we would dance with the dogs, all of us together. We chased them, they chased us. We circled tail to tail. We wore spotted gowns, flowered gowns, striped gowns, plain. When the moon was high, the music would stop. The dancing stopped. We froze. Mrs. Bethel Utmeyer, the oldest resident of my heaven, would bring out her violin. Holly tread lightly on her horn. They would do a duet. One woman old and silent. One woman not past girl yet. Back and forth, a crazy schizoid solace they'd create. All the dancers would slowly go inside. The song reverberated until Holly, for a final time, passed the tune over. And Mrs. Utmeyer, quiet, upright, historical, finished with a jig. The house asleep by then, this was my even song.
This ends Disc 1.